This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a great day to have you with us to talk about, well, the topic of the day that we're going to begin with is an organization that I had never heard of before, but has a very interesting name. It's Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. And we're joined by phone by David Jenkins. He's the president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. He joins us from Virginia, where they have their home office. David, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Describe your organization. What is the mission?
Okay. Well, we're a national grassroots organization of basically what the name says. You know, we're conservatives who care about conservation and stewardship of our natural resources. And those are two things that we believe are fundamentally conservative values. You know, conserve and conservatism, they all have the same root word. That makes a lot of sense to us that one thing we're supposed to do as conservatives is to be good stewards of our natural resources and the environment. And that's something that I think has been a little bit lost on the right side of the political aisle these days. And we want to remind people that that's what conservatism should be about.
How big is your organization? Who belongs?
We have about 15,000 members nationwide. And, you know, it's people who recognize that conservation is conservative, and they've been a little bit dismayed at why the conservative, you know, side of politics, or people who claim to be conservative, have sort of overlooked this and sort of left that issue and those set of issues up to folks on the left. When, if you look through our history, most of the major conservation accomplishments in this country were put in by people on the conservative side. You go back to Teddy Roosevelt. You can go to Nixon and the Clean Air Act and Endangered Species Act and all those. You go to Reagan and the Montreal Protocol, George H.W. Bush and the Clean Air Act amendments. You just go down the line. And these things, these protections have been put in place by Republicans. They've stood the test of time. They're still in place today. And yet, here we are. We see a lot of people today that claim to be conservative, but they're trying to tear all that down.
What happened?
I kind of trace it back to when Gingrich was Speaker of the House, and there were some folks, actually mostly Western, that were really libertarian in their views, not really conservative, and they had an axe to grind on, you know, these environmental protections or natural resource protections, public land protections, and when they got in, they started going down that road, and then, you know, talk show hosts that are more libertarian like Rush Limbaugh and those guys were beating that drum too. And for some reason, people just lost track of what it really means to be conservative.
Why make the ideological distinction?
Well, you mean?
I mean, you mentioned that liberals or progressives are sort of mentioning they're big on the environmental protection and conservation issues. Why make a distinction about ideology?
It shouldn't be. I mean, from our perspective, this should be completely a bipartisan issue. Now, the solutions may be different that people propose, but they should all be trying to solve the same problems. Nixon said that this is a cause beyond party and beyond faction, and Reagan said something similar as well, and that's so true.
So there is this split among conservatives and Republicans specifically that you aim to mend a bit. How receptive to your ideas are the people you want to reach?
Oh, I mean, the general population of Republicans they've always been where we are. They understand stewardship. They understand conservation. Those are things that they see as inherently conservative about, you know, and part of their identity. But where the problem comes in is with usually the political set, the members of Congress or state legislators and stuff that get in there and, I don't know whether it's just them listening to special interest or whether, you know, we've been putting in very hardcore libertarian types that have lost kind of sight of that. But what we're getting out of the political right these days is more radicalism than it is conservatism.
Well, let's jump into a few of these issues. Global warming or climate change, that one seems to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny is back in the late 1980s, Ronald Reagan recognized that climate change was an issue. He called it the greenhouse effect, and his administration pledged to study the issue and see if there's ways that they could address it. much like they addressed ozone depletion with the Montreal Protocol. And then his good friend, Margaret Thatcher, she went around the world talking about how we need to wake up and pay attention to the climate and make sure that we are good stewards of the earth so we can leave a better place for our children and grandchildren. And that's true conservatism. And they were saying that, you know, what now, 30 years ago? It's amazing that from there, from conservative icons being at that place, that suddenly now, here we are with, you know, a lot of people, you know, the president, the head of EPA, denying the whole thing.
Yes, and that's sort of the climate denial piece here is the one that is most intriguing because there is a fair amount of science and, of course, real-life experience that some people can point to about things are changing.
Yeah, and, you know, conservatism is supposed to be based on facts, not emotion. You know, you're supposed to look at things objectively and come up with answers that make sense. And too much, you know, on the right, you know, we always used to criticize the left for just acting with emotion and not really looking at facts. And here we go. It seems like the roles have been reversed all of a sudden.
I went up on your website, and I would direct our listeners to it as well. It's conservativestewards.org. There was a statement about energy development there. I'm just going to read it briefly. Renewables like wind and solar are less established than fossil fuels, and while they could compete in a subsidy-free energy market, long-entrenched fossil fuel subsidies currently skew the market. The organization opposes efforts to single out wind and solar tax incentives for elimination while ignoring those that benefit competing energy sources like gas, oil, and coal. Those are pretty provocative words in a state like North Dakota.
Well, it's a fact. And the thing is you know, energy, there's no source of energy that's blue or red. I mean, energy is energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it all should be treated the same. And in our tax code, there's a lot of built-in benefits that's been tied to oil and gas production and things like that. I mean, even tax subsidies for railroads come in to help, like coal and things like that. So, you know, for people to just point their fingers only at any kind of incentives or help that you get on the solar, wind, or you know, anything like that, and not point their fingers at the other stuff, that's not being objective. And what it's doing is people are buying into basically special interest talking points. Industry puts out talking points, you know, Koch brothers and those organizations put out these talking points, and people buy into them without even thinking about, you know, the underlying facts.
Is more money invested in messaging and contributions to politicians to remove conservation protections than preserve them?
Well, yeah. I would say that's a pretty safe bet. The other thing that really works against us is the gerrymandering that's been done over the years where you get a lot of people in these safe districts and they don't have to you know, challenge their thinking about things listen to all their constituents to feel like they can get reelected. So if you look at conservatives and Republicans that are in more competitive districts, you'll see that they tend to be more proactive on these kind of issues, too, to make sure that the other side doesn't own the claim of only being the only ones that are trying to be good stewards.
Now, every party has sort of a spectrum there. You mentioned the Republican Party, the Libertarians, and that kind of influence there. Would the members of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship typically fall under the heading of moderate Republican?
I mean, some of us, yes, but we have all types. I mean, I'm a pretty strong, diehard social conservative, and we have plenty of those. And really, to us, the distinction comes back between traditionalist Republican or traditionalist conservatives and libertarians, because you don't want to get too much into the history of it, but you can go back to Edmund Burke and Russell Kirk and people like that that are the sort of the sources of conservatism as a philosophy. and you know, all the principles that they stood on, in terms of you know, like Kirk said, every right is married to a duty, and every freedom owes a corresponding responsibility. And those are the kind of things that Reagan touted, that you know, kind of philosophy that Theodore Roosevelt had, and is all about being responsible and doing the best thing for not just the present generation, but for future generations. That's conservatism. And now we hear that rhetoric on the other side when we should be owning it. Why shouldn't Republicans and conservatives be proud of the Antiquities Act, which was all passed by Republicans, or the Clean Air Act, which a Republican administration pushed through, you know, or Reagan's accomplishments in the Montreal Protocol? You don't hear anyone on talk radio praising Reagan for his environmental accomplishments. So we should be embracing those things instead of running away from them.
You forwarded a news release to us, or your publicist did, that points to North Dakota's flaring issues and the Bureau of Land Management's methane and waste prevention rule. And you say in this news release, did you know that the oil and gas operators in North Dakota are wasting millions of dollars of natural gas each year? Make that argument.
Yes, it's what they're doing. I mean, what they're doing is they're cutting corners, and they're through flaring, through venting, and through leaks, they're not capturing all their gas. And so this is gas that's being produced on public lands that are owned by all of us. So when they waste these resources, they're wasting public resources that we all own. And when they produce gas from these fields that are on public lands, they pay royalties to the Treasury, which essentially paying royalties to taxpayers, to like you and me. So it helps decrease the deficit and reduces the chances that the government will have to raise taxes at some point. But when they waste that gas, we're not getting any kind of revenue from that. We're not getting the benefit of the energy itself. And then on top of that, we're getting the pollution. So to us, requiring best practices makes a lot of sense. And that there was a rule in place put in by the past administration, but modeled after something that happened at the state level in Colorado that's been very successful and the industry's thrived under. And yet here they start pushing back on this and saying, oh, we can't do this. Congressman Cramer and you know, others have bought into this and said, oh, well, we want to push back and we want to roll back this standard, and the Trump administration has been going as hard as they can to try to do so.
David Jenkins is the president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. He speaks to us from Virginia, where they have their headquarters. David, you mentioned that there are about 15,000 members of your organization across the country. How would you describe your presence in North Dakota?
I haven't looked at those numbers per se lately, but you know, North Dakota is not going to be as many as more, you know, populous states, but we have a healthy membership. I couldn't characterize it as whether it's dozens or hundreds, but we have a healthy membership in the state.
You have other issues too, besides global warming and the flaring stuff. National monument preservation, the Arctic Refuge. Elaborate on these issues a bit.
Well, yeah, with the national monuments, it's really interesting. That the Antiquities Act, which gives the presidents the authority to establish national monuments, which must be established on public land, so it's not anything to do with private land. That was introduced by a Republican in Congress in 1906. It was passed by a Republican Congress. It was signed into law by a Republican president. It's been used by Republican presidents and Democrat presidents alike for over 100 years, and it's what protected the Grand Canyon. It's what initially protected parts of the Grand Tetons, Acadia National Park in Maine, Devil's Tower in Wyoming. You can just go down the list. And so those things would not have been protected if that tool was not available, because, you know, Congress doesn't always act fast. And so when there's a threat to something, the wisdom of the Antiquities Act is that you let the president act quickly, and then Congress can They can reverse it if they want to, but usually these things have been very popular and Congress can't reverse them. So the people who don't like protecting these places for you know, these kind of features like their geologic features or archaeological features, they'd rather have them open to development, so they push back on this kind of thing. When if you look at the Antiquities Act and what it was for and why it was put in place, I mean, I view it as a very conservative thing. So we support keeping our national monuments. Nobody's ever tried to roll them back before, and in fact, the you know, the Trump administration is trying to roll some back, and we think that deviates from the actual law. The law allows the president to create a monument. It's a one-way authority. It doesn't allow them to roll it back the other way. And we think the courts will, you know, in the courts, that side will prevail, and the rollbacks will be deemed not lawful.
Well, you mentioned President Trump, and of course the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and the Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke. They're all players in all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Are these issues the kind of issues that would make you vote one way or the other?
Well, you know, I think voters certainly it makes sense to place a higher priority on these issues in determining who they vote for, because I think one of the big problems is while most people who consider themselves conservative or on the right side of the political aisle, they have strong stewardship ethics, they have strong conservation ethics, and they support doing things. They support fuel economy standards. They support protecting national monuments. But the thing is, they have other issues that they put higher up than that, whether it's foreign affairs, whether it's social issues, whatever it is. And in doing that, these lawmakers realize that they can just listen to special interests and not the people who vote for them. And they're never going to be held accountable because people are going to vote for them for some other reason, and they're going to ignore the fact that they did bad things on the environment. I mean, just how crazy it is if you think about it. There's a lot of Republican lawmakers are certainly pro-life from the standpoint of the abortion issue, but then at the same time they want to loosen restrictions on mercury, which harms, you know, unborn children. So, you know, how can you care about life and not hold them accountable for inconsistencies in their policies?
Well, would you hold them accountable when you go to the polls?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you ultimately have to if they don't change. But I think the preference, and certainly the preference from our point of view, is that you put pressure on these folks and you stay on the conservative side, voting for conservatives. But you know, in the primary process and other things, you select conservatives that are good on these issues. And if they're not good on these issues, and none of them are good on these issues, I mean, there's plenty of options. I mean, you can write in somebody else, you know, that is good. We saw, you know, like when in the primaries, when Senator McCain was there, or when he wasn't there, when Romney was there, or when Trump was there, I know people who've written in McCain or written in John Kasich or whatever, because they would be more mindful of our stewardship responsibilities than maybe some of the other choices out there.
David Jenkins is the president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. You can find out more at conservativestewards.org. That's their online presence. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, part two of Harvest Public Media's report on beef genetics.
Even though this winter never seems to end, it's officially spring, and that means Prairie Public Spring Member Drive is coming soon. You know, we come to you just a couple of times a year and ask you directly for your help in funding the statewide radio network and online service. It's been our listener members in the past who have helped make Prairie Public North Dakota's trusted home for NPR News, excellent regional news coverage, and valued cultural and music programs. It's been that way for a long time, but with previously consistent other sources of funding either reduced or eliminated, we're turning to our members even more so now. We have an ambitious goal of 265 contributions for this member drive, and you can really help get a head start on that goal right now. Become a sustaining force with your membership. It's a powerful gesture, but it's easy. Just call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org. And thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday, we heard about expensive bull semen and the global beef herd. But a lot of beef genetics are still shared the old-fashioned way by setting a bull loose with cows in a pasture. Now there's a new tool that's helping farmers zero in on specific traits they want to improve in their herds. In this report from Harvest Public Media, Christopher Husted explains why this will matter to the beef consumer.
About 100 people gather inside a large barn for a cattle auction in Salisbury, Missouri. They sit down in bleachers surrounding a sales ring. 88 cattle are up for sale today. Most will fetch a few thousand dollars. As the bull from Lot 20 is brought into the ring, the auctioneer describes it with words and numbers.
You want to talk about a genetic masterpiece. He's a bull that's going to grow to the top 1% of the breed for wean weight and for yearling weight.
Genetics, top percentage points. This Lot 20 bull, whose name is Southside, was DNA tested to see how he compares to others in the Angus breed. Next to his photo in the sales catalog is what looks like a baseball card. It includes his birth date, weight, and a chart of statistics from his DNA test. Ranchers always analyze how a prospective bull's progeny have developed over generations. But now, science is gaining ground. The American Angus Association introduced a genomic testing kit in November. For $37 a pop, ranchers can send a tissue or blood sample in and receive a readout on how a bull's genetic makeup compares to others in the breed. All 88 cattle selling at the Salisbury auction had been tested. Kelly Ritalik is the genetic services director for the Angus Association's breeding arm.
Genomic testing allows us to basically find animals that are better for traits like marbling earlier, that have a bigger tendency to basically pass down those traits later on in life as parents. And so that's how we create a better product for the consumer.
Ritalik says the Angus Association has 467,000 genomic profiles of cattle to reference when it analyzes a DNA sample. Researchers help narrow in on traits that indicate which bulls would produce the fastest growing calves, which would grow the biggest ribeyes. Jared Decker is a cattle geneticist at the University of Missouri.
If we have a genomic-based, a DNA-based genetic prediction, there's less possibility for that genetic prediction to change as we get more data back on that animal. And so it's taking some of that risk out of the equation.
Predictability helps cut costs for ranchers. And down the line, that could mean lower prices for consumers, Decker says. But for DNA tests to be useful, ranchers have to benchmark their livestock with measurements and ultrasound scans that correspond to the DNA. Wes Tiemann is a cattle sales director and producer from central Missouri. He was running the auction in Salisbury.
If we're not turning in those weights and if we don't get that hard information, those scans, 5 years down the road, our DNA doesn't mean anything to us because the DNA has changed. These animals have changed and evolved through selection pressure.
Tiemann says more clients are asking about the genomics of cattle for sale every week, and he expects that to continue as demand for beef grows. And that's the final piece of the picture. Across the globe, people are hungry for beef, quality beef. Coming down the pipeline, researchers are working on tailored DNA tests that can better predict how productive cattle will be in specific environments with humidity, elevation, or toxic vegetation. Back at the cattle auction in Salisbury, Missouri, hands shoot up and heads nod at the auctioneer for the bull named Southside. The price jumps up to $9,000, $10,000, $11,000.
Well, last call. Thank you for what you did do. At 11 time, you're going to get 12, you're going to get 12, you're going to get 12,000. So 11,500, 11,500.
Southside is the most expensive bull sold tonight. He will go off to a farm to breed for a rancher trying to grow the highest quality beef for the lowest input costs. And at next year's cattle auction, ranchers likely will have more traits available in each bull's genomic profile for decision making. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at America's food and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with Tanner Cherney. He won an award for his role in Devil's Lake tourism, and we'll also have our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news with Todd.
Thank you, Doug. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration says, on average, two workers are killed each month in trench collapses. Now, OSHA, The North Dakota Safety Council and other state organizations have signed on to an official safety alliance with the goal of preventing trenching-related accidents. Safety Council Executive Director Chuck Claremont says OSHA has spotlighted trench safety.
They've said, why wait until something happens and now do it after the fact? Let's be more proactive to prevent these things from happening. And so if the awareness is out there, people are getting the training, hopefully what happens is we continue to see those statistics going down.
Safety Council consultant Dustin Austin has worked with the Mondak Safety Alliance for 15 years before joining the council.
We have a lot of people coming here from out of state and a lot of people from in-state. A lot of trench and excavation activities going on. And with as much as going on, we're trying to get ahead of the problems. Instead of responding to a lot of deaths right now, let's get ahead of this so that we can prevent those deaths and those injuries in the future.
Austin says education is a key, and so is training. A welfare check by Grand Forks Police this morning led to the discovery of four deceased individuals at a home in South Grand Forks. Police were asked to check on the home by administration officials at Lewis and Clark Elementary School. When officers arrived, they observed what appeared to be a body inside and forcibly entered the home. Authorities say there are no indications of any threat to the public. They add the incident is vigorously being investigated. Police Lieutenant Derek Zimmel says the investigation will take time.
Especially when people are deceased. Something tragic has happened here, and we need to make sure that we're doing things the right way.
The names of the deceased are not being released at this time. Grand Forks school officials say the victims include a parent and three students. Senator John Hoeven says there's been a lot of support put behind the Red River Diversion Project from all levels. He says while the diversion is important to the Fargo-Moorhead area, the private-public partnership used to develop the project is becoming an item of interest for others.
We have the equation. This P3 project is an equation that the rest of the country is looking at. I mean, right now, this is the P3 project for the Corps of Engineers.
In a meeting with the Metro Flood Diversion Authority, Hoeven says as the group works its way toward getting a needed permit from Minnesota and through a lawsuit by diversion opponents, the project has the support of the Army Corps. He says proof of that support was shown during a meeting this week with Corps officials. He says officials have backed a request to continue funding the project.
This year, the request that I've received is $35 million. That's what I believe we'll have in the work plan is $35 million for this year. That has to go through the OMB process. So we're never done until we get it through the OMB process, but we're tracking very well on it.
Senator John Hoeven. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
The other thing young women know is if you're going to go out with a stranger, you meet them at a neutral place and you call at least one friend and say who you're going out with and where you're going. So I proceeded to call no one and give Mark my address. I thought, if this guy's a murderer, this could solve all my problems.
Join us for more stories told live. This week, six stories by women around the world. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by phone by Tanner Cherney. He is a visitor service and outdoor media coordinator for Devil's Lake Tourism, and he joins us to talk about his new award. Congratulations on winning the Governor's Travel and Tourism Award, the Heritage Award, Tanner.
Well, thank you, Doug. Thank you very much.
What does it mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. You know, I was actually very surprised when they announced my name at the Travel Industry Conference here. Oh, it must have been about 2 weeks ago now, when they kind of did a little presentation that afternoon at our luncheon and kind of went through all the awards. And when they pulled up the first one of the day and it was the Heritage Award, which is for frontline tourism employees in the state of North Dakota, I was greatly shocked when my name was the one that was announced as the recipient of it for this year. And you know, it means a lot to me just the fact I've been in this industry now for about 4 years here. In the next 2 weeks, it'll be 4 years, and working with the tourism industry in the state of North Dakota and Devil's Lake here in particular is a great place to be, and I just love working with all of the visitors coming in, whether they're traveling in through the state and just stopping for a night, or the anglers or sportsmen that are coming in for hunting, whether it be I love visiting with everyone and trying to kind of point everyone in the right direction so they have an enjoyable stay or trip to Devil's Lake and North Dakota.
And since you're a frontline tourism employee, that means you actually do interact with these visitors.
Yes, I know. It started out, you know, a lot of, we have our own little visitor center here in Devil's Lake at our office. So, you know, a lot of stuff, especially from Memorial Day to Labor Day, is kind of daily interactions with the visitors that are coming in and have questions, whether they're looking for a hotel to stay at or places to eat or campgrounds. You know, the touchy subject of always trying to find a fishing spot for people, trying to do our best to try to point them in the right direction so everyone has a good chance of getting out in the water. And then also Devil's Lake Tourism here, we go to about 3 to 4 different sports shows throughout the season, usually from about December through March is our sports show season, and that's where we go to Sioux Falls and Milwaukee and Minneapolis and are there at about 3 to 4 days at our little booth and interacting with thousands of people throughout the weekend there, just kind of getting them information on Devil's Lake and, you know, kind of helping answer any questions that they may have.
Well, visitor service, that's what we've been talking about, getting in front of people, talking to them, or going to those trade shows and talking up the visitor potential for Devil's Lake. Let's talk about this other part of your job description, though, outdoor media coordinator. Describe that.
Yeah, that's kind of new. You know, in the last 4 years, my job role has kind of changed. Kind of started out as tourism assistant to begin with, and then over the course of the last two years, we've noticed a new way of marketing for Devil's Lake, and what we've been doing is different media events where we'll, you know, it's always one thing for us to sell our story of Devil's Lake and how we're a good fishing destination or we're in the waterfall flyway here in the central flyway, but what we've really noticed that's really been beneficial to us is we'll host, like, outdoor writers, different TV shows, different media personalities, and basically over the last 2 years I've been kind of involved with finding those writers, connecting with them, inviting them up to Devil's Lake, and then basically showing them around and kind of getting them the taste of Devil's Lake and helping them whether they're looking for story ideas. And then hopefully potentially that in the next month or two after they're up, they'll go back to their respective media outlet and write an article on Devil's Lake on how their experience was and what they thought of it. And kind of, you know, one person has a trust another source, so it's other than just us trying to tell the story, it's a great way for other people to share what kind of experience they actually had up here. So it's been kind of a unique thing that's allowed me to actually get out into the field and do some fishing and hunting while I'm still doing my 8-to-5 job, so it's not just confined to an office. I actually get out to enjoy some of the different things to do out here.
So occasionally you're a fishing guide?
Not so much a guide, but a fishing tour person, I would say.
Okay, you don't want to infringe on anybody else's occupation, I take it.
Yep, but it's been, it's kind of cool because there'll be days where you have like a TV show up and you get to go out for a day or two with them and be on camera and actually talk about Devil's Lake and, you know, the history of how the flooding changed this whole fishery and created what it is today. And, you know, a lot of guys don't know that story, so it's been beneficial that I've been able to be out in the boat there and kind of talk on the tourism side of things, not only just the fishing, but what we have to offer along with our fishery here.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, about 20 years ago, the lake was rising and flooding everything around it. It was before those big dikes were put up and the pumps were installed and all that. Did Devil's Lake, or did you at that time expect it to become the bigger tourism attraction it has become?
You know, I didn't really, and honestly, until I started working at the tourism office here. I mean, I've always been a fisher and a fisherman and a hunter ever since I was a little boy. And I almost kind of took it for granted at that point until I started working here and realizing the amount of people that do come. I think there was an art study done here a couple of years ago that said the average distance of a person traveled one way that comes to fish Devil's Lake is about like 350 to 400 miles, which is, you know, touching that Minneapolis area. So I kind of took it for granted and never realized, you know, how awesome of a fishery we have here and never really got to look at it from the outside like I have now. And now I try to take advantage of it as much as I can when you realize people are taking their weeks of vacation to come up here and enjoy it when I can get off of work at 5 and be on the water by 5:15. And people try to do that at least once a year up here, and I can almost do it every other day.
Well, back in the day, it was a smaller and saltier lake and probably didn't have the kind of tourism allure that it does now. How important is tourism to Devil's Lake?
Tourism is actually very important to Devil's Lake. It's our, of course, in the state, it's the number 3 industry. But here in Ramsey County, it's our number 2 industry right behind agriculture. And it kind of helps in those off seasons when, especially if, you know, farming, the inputs down and all that kind of stuff, the tourism is kind of a buffer here that allows some stuff during the spring and summer seasons when there's not as much egg economy going on. So it's a big beneficial factor to our community. It's been kind of nice over the last 5-6 years here. You've seen there's been probably 3 or 4 hotels that have popped up. We've had a couple more restaurants open up in town. We've also had a few more resorts now be able to, now that the lake's kind of reached its peak of the flooding, that there's been a few more resorts that have popped up and all kinds of campgrounds. So it's been awesome to see the amount of community support for providing different infrastructure here for tourism that is coming into the community.
Well, what goes up can come down. Is there any concern that, you know, that wet cycle that created the greater Devil's Lake that we have now will someday change over to whatever cycle created the smaller lake?
There is always that thought in the back of everyone's mind, although there's still a ton of water out here. I think the last report I heard was like over 170,000 acres.
Wow.
But talking with some people that have fished it when I was just a little kid in the early 90s, and it was, like you said, just a small little lake, they talked about how great of a fishery it was at that point even. So who knows if it goes down a little bit, how it'll affect it. But you know what? It's one of those things you almost just kind of got to ride it while it's here and enjoy it while you can.
Well, you also produce video fishing reports. You post on the tourism site's website and Facebook page. So that keeps you busy too?
Yes, it does. And that was something we just started here about a year ago now. We've always had our Facebook page presence. We've noticed a lot of people following that. So what we kind of did was we used to always do a fishing report, but now we've gone to more video reports. And that way, if I'm out on the water, pull out the phone and just do a quick minute and a half update and kind of talking to people on, you know, what the weather's like, how the bite is, what particular lures or presentations are working in some general areas. And in a matter of 5 minutes, we can pop that onto our Facebook page, our YouTube page, and right to our website so everyone can have a up-to-date report just like that. So we've actually noticed a very big increase in our viewage on that versus just having a regular old typed-out report, which we still do occasionally. But no, the video reports have been something that's turned out really awesome here in the last year.
When does the prime summer fishing season get underway?
You know, right now, I would say about beginning of June is when things really kick off for the summer. Once you have the water temps get a little bit warmer, weather stabilizes out from the spring. From about June on, it's kind of game time until about freeze up again. And that's the one thing that is kind of interesting when you talk to a lot of people that are coming up here. They always are leery coming up to fish Devil's Lake on around July and August times because everyone always thinks the dog days of summer, hot weather, stagnant fishing, the fish kind of get slower and not as active. But up here, it almost seems like they pick up and you have better fishing towards the those dog days of summer.
Well, you describe yourself as an avid angler and hunter. So what's your favorite kind of a day in the summer?
My favorite kind of day would be when you can get into the shallow waters, get up at sunrise, get into the shallow waters, and you throw out a slip bobber, and then you can have that after the side of the boat, and then also putting a little jig on with like a plastic paddle tail on that and casting the shorelines while you're anchored up there. I don't know what it is, but I never get sick of watching a bobber go under the water.
Nobody does.
No.
So when somebody comes to the visitor center for the Devil's Lake Tourism Department, there's a big map of the lake there, I assume. Do you point
there
to it and say, there's a nice spot right there?
Yep. You know, I try to give as many spots as I can to people without trying to be like, oh, there's going to be 30 people at that one, you know, trying to disperse everyone evenly or even just give them general information per se, like, July when the trolling bite is the most productive. And, you know, maybe it might not be one spot is producing over another, but it might just be, hey, you want to find 20 to 25 feet of water, and that's going to be where the old shoreline break lines are from 20 years ago. And that time of the year, that's a good spot to try, and you just start trolling, and this is the right bottom bouncer and spinner size to use, and basically you start covering water until you get a bite. And if you get a bite, mark that on your GPS and keep turning back and forth over those spots. But yeah, you know, you try to push people in the right direction, because I've been in that same boat when I go to places, and I did that a couple months ago. I was in Minnesota to try crappie fishing for the first time, and I had no clue to where to fish at, and kind of was in the same boat asking some people, you know, what's a general area to try? I don't need your honey hole, but just something, you know, what should I use for tackle, and where should I look for to target on a lake map?
Now, do you work with the Spirit Lake Tribe?
You know, that is something we're going to be doing probably here real soon. I know they just, I want to say it was in this last year, they hired a tourism director out there for the tribe, and I think they're going to start doing what I heard at the travel industry conference here 2 weeks ago, is that they're going to start working on getting horse riding trails out there.
Well, because they do have the casino, and of course that's an attraction as well. Just
yep.
whatever brings people in is probably good for Greater Devil's Lake.
It is, and you know, they got beautiful cabins out there now too, and a little marina and all that. So there's a kind of a whole agglomeration of people working together here to try to boost our tourism.
Now, you said you've been working with Devil's Lake Tourism for about 4 years now. What's your goal? What's your career goal, Tanner?
You know, I want to keep working in this industry with fishing and hunting one way or another. Right now, I just want to kind of, I really haven't even thought about that for a while, because it's just been, I've been enjoying my job right now, and, you know, it's one of those things, you get up in the morning, you go to work, and it really doesn't feel like you're at work, so as long as I can keep doing that while I'm alive, that's my goal, is to just enjoy whatever I'm doing.
And how did you fall into the job in the first place?
Well, I actually I graduated back in May of 14 from college at Mayville State University, and I was looking at a couple different jobs, and I just happened to look in the paper here back home in Devil's Lake and noticed that there was a job opening here at the local tourism office, and thought, you know what, might be something interesting. I was I worked the summer before that as a fishing guide for Mitchell's Guide Service in Devil's Lake. And I thought, you know, that was kind of my backup plan if I couldn't find a job right away, that maybe I would just lean on being a fishing guide until I figured out where I was going to end up, and submitted my resume to the tourism office here and got an interview, and one thing led to another, and it's kind of opened a ton of doors now, and one of those things I've never really looked back on.
And what was your major at Mayville State?
It was business administration.
Okay. Well, it's not an alien discipline for what you're doing, actually. So,
no, not at all.
Well, all the best to you, Tanner.
Well, thank you very much.
Tanner Cherney is a visitor service and outdoor media coordinator for Devil's Lake Tourism and the Convention and Visitors Bureau there. And he spoke to us by phone from Devil's Lake. Coming up next, what's happening?
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people, because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're yes. Not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that's the question. It's Thursday. The weekend is looming. It's May and spring is here. It's time to look at what's happening with Ashley Thornburg.
And with this weather, go outside. How about going on a hike, a birding hike, Saturday the 5th of May in our villa at the chalet parking lot at the Turtle River State Park. Meet up at the chalet at 7 a.m. and find out who is hiding in the park. We've started hearing birds. Boy, it seemed like it took a long time to hear them this year. Bring your own binoculars. If you have them, they do have some limited pairs available to borrow as well. 7 to 9 a.m. at Turtle River State Park. Meet at the parking lot there at the chalet, and it's free.
And if you're looking for something to do as the sun is heading down, the Moors is getting great buzz for Theater B. Their theater is in Moorhead at 10th Street and 2nd Avenue North. Thursday through Saturday evenings, the Moors runs this week with a matinee on Sunday. The curtain is at 7:30 for the evening performances and 2 o'clock for the matinee. It's set on a bleak and unforgiving landscape. This wildly theatrical dark comedy is full of mystery, humor, and surprise. Part Bronte sisters, part Twilight Zone, the Moors ensnares its bold and obsessive characters in an elaborate game to make their mark in the world. Thursday evenings are $5 for students, $20 for seniors and adults, and enjoy the show.
All right, I'm staying outside with the 20th annual Kite Day celebration at Lindenwood Park in Fargo. This is also coming up on Saturday the 5th. Bring your own kite and show off your flying skills. There's going to be some free hot dogs and Pepsi for people to drink. The event itself, of course, is free. You are welcome to attend and watch, or better yet, participate and show off those flying skills. If nothing else, get some great fresh air. 12:30 to 3:30 on Saturday in Fargo at Lindenwood Park.
I'll stay outside. Family Astronomy Nights 2018 is Friday in East Grand Forks at the East Grand Forks Heritage Village. Dave Thompson, our punster, would love this. May the 4th be with you. Join Northern Sky Astronomical Society as they kick off the summer free Family Astronomy Nights. There will be a presentation about black holes, time travel, and wormholes, followed by telescope viewing of the moon and planets. It starts at 8 o'clock Friday evening at East Grand Forks Heritage Village, and it's free.
Well, yes, may the 4th be with all of us. Star Wars party and movie on Friday, May 4th in Minot at the Ward County Public Library. Celebrate Star Wars with this party and movie for kids, you know, 5 years and up. There are games, crafts, treats. They're going to be showing The Last Jedi. The movie begins at 4:30. The event itself, you can come a little early, hang out. That gets going at 3:30, the movie at 4:30, and it's free. Again on Friday, May 4th, may the 4th be with you, in Minot at the Ward County Public Library.
And if you want to see a stage show in Minot, the Mouse River Players present 12 Angry Jurors. It runs Friday through Sunday. That is through the 13th of May. That's Sunday. And it's in Minot at the Arlene. A 19-year-old man has just stood trial for the fatal stabbing of his father. "He doesn't stand a chance," mutters the guard as the 12 jurors are taken into the bleak jury room. It looks like an open and shut case until one of the jurors begins opening the other's eyes to the facts. This is became a pretty great movie as well. At 7:30 for the evening performances, Sunday matinees at 2 o'clock, and it is $10 to $15 to see the Mouse River Players production of 12 Angry Jurors in Minot at the Arlene.
You can check out a brass band Sunday the 6th in Dickinson at Dickinson State University. There's going to be a group of trumpets, French horn, trombone, and tuba performers doing a repertoire of classics and original compositions going anywhere from Baroque and classical to jazz and pop. This group in particular, this is called the Alias Brass Company, and they are known for their entertaining presentation style, adding choreography. Can you imagine dancing and trying to hold a tuba at the same time?
No, I can't.
Multi-talented people here. 3 o'clock in Dickinson at Dickinson State University on Sunday, May 6th, and it's free.
The Plains Art Museum Spring Gala Black and White is Saturday in downtown Fargo at the Plains Art Museum. This year's theme, Black and White, will be sported by gala goers in traditional and creative ways. The fundraiser features gourmet food, wine, music by post-traumatic funk syndrome, and art for auction. Proceeds support the museum's mission. It runs from 7 to midnight Saturday at the Plains Art Museum. Tickets are $100. Again, there's all that stuff with it online at plainsart.org.
All right, my pick of the week is Looking Back and Looking Ahead Through the Eyes of Hubble. This is Tuesday the 8th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center and State Museum. NASA Program Manager Maurice Henderson is presenting at the Heritage Center, and he is going to explore the 28-year journey of Hubble and all the things that we have learned and have yet to learn because of this amazing telescope. 7 o'clock at the Heritage Center in Bismarck, and it's free.
Well, mine is this, I Am, He Said. That's the name of the show, Saturday in Fargo at the Fargo Theater. Matt Vallien is the nephew of the late Bobby V. He played with his group for years. Matt is a tremendous performer, and he pays tribute to another great singer in this show. Again, it's I Am, He Said, so that would be Neil Diamond. It's a showcase of Diamond's hits, including, of course, Sweet Caroline. The music starts at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Fargo Theater. Tickets are $32.50. And that's what's happening.
In a special family concert Sunday, May 6th at 3 p.m., the Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra brings to the capital city Blessings from the Children by Gwyneth Walker. This chorus and orchestra work will feature the Jubilate Chorus from Central Dakota Children's Choir. Other works on the program include Three Billy Goats Gruff for narrator and string quintet, and The Tin Forest, using recycled items for instruments, by Minnesota composer Steve Heitzig. The concert is conducted by Dennis Gawin with Don Hagerot and takes place at House of Prayer Lutheran Church in South Bismarck. Tickets are available at the door.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 3rd. John M. Joyce was born in Minot on November 15, 1944. A little over 2 months after World War II ended. While Joyce missed that conflict, he came of age during another, the Vietnam War. There were many people who did not want to fight, but Joyce was not among them. He could have received a deferment after graduating, but instead chose to join the Marines and proved his strength and leadership by becoming a platoon commander. Unfortunately, Joyce was killed on April 17, 1963, while leading his platoon through a jungle. A little over 2 weeks later, on this date, he was laid to rest in his hometown of Minot. Joyce is one of the 198 North Dakotans who lost their life in the Vietnam War. Each of these soldiers have unique stories, but what is interesting about Joyce is that you can read firsthand accounts about him in Ronald Jensen's book, Tail End Charlie, Memoir of a United States Marine in the Vietnam War. Jensen was one of the soldiers in Joyce's platoon and speaks highly of him, describing him as never seeming to be above his men, always working with them. The morning before Joyce died, he helped Jensen by taking half of the heavy C-4 load he was carrying. The same day, he suffered several bullet wounds during a firefight. Clearly, Joyce had gained the respect of his men, for Jensen and three others carried him to camp as fast as they could, though Joyce eventually died. Left behind are Jensen's first-hand stories that paint a picture of a man who was fiercely duty-bound and who had a deep love for the men who served with him. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Friday on Main Street, our Bill Thomas visits the Butterhorn Restaurant in Bismarck, where he chats with Chef Stephanie Miller. Speaking of food, Chuck Lura says it's time to hunt morel mushrooms in Friday's Natural North Dakota essay. Tom Ezrin will have a Plainsfolk essay titled Operation Snowbound, and we'll have our regular Friday news chat with News Director Dave Thompson, and Madeline will review the new Avengers movie. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.